All right, so we're going to talk about Silicon Valley Bank.
Yeah.
What happened and maybe what investors should understand or think about as far as protection moving forward.
Yeah, so Silicon Valley Bank is a smallish kind of bank that it's been around for a while, but it's been kind of catering really to a clientele of sort of startup, techie, Silicon Valley type companies. It's in the name. And so what they had done was, and the way the banks work generally is, you know, the deposits are there, the bank pays some small amount of interest on that to the customers. And then all that money, not all of it, but most of it is available to lend out as in the form of loans or to invest in the form of higher yielding securities, whatever the case may be. There are regulations that apply to the big giant banks, you know, the JP Morgans and the Citis and the mega banks, that are much more strict than those that apply to smaller and regional banks. And that's part of the issue. But and that whole thing came out of the financial crisis of 08-09. So the big banks that were the most systemically risky to the overall economy and world were subject to much more strict requirements. That's one aspect. Secondly,
meaning, sorry to interrupt, have a certain amount of money,
how much you have to reserve against what you have and restrictions on what you can do with your reserves, that sort of stuff. So within the past several weeks or so, the bank started to realize that we didn't do a good job of investing our reserves. They invested it in longer maturity treasuries. They didn't invest in anything risky or fraudulent or exotic at all. It was just pure incompetence, because what banks normally do is, if they're investing in, say, longer dated bonds to get higher yields than what they're paying their depositors, that's the spread they earn, that's their profit. But typically you want to hedge against interest rate moves and to avoid what happened here. But when you hedge against it, you're minimizing or you're reducing profits. So this was a case of a lot of ways of greed. It's a publicly traded company. The stock was doing really well. The executives' primary form of compensation is the stock. And so they were, you know, there were incentives for them to not hedge and to mismanage the risk of what they were doing. And I'll say it again, like, running a bank is as simple as that. Like, you have deposits, you invest them in higher yielding things like loans or bonds, and you keep the spread, and then you go on to the next day and do it again. Well, they forgot the risk management part of that. The other problem of this bank in particular is that its customers were largely companies, tech companies, and their founders and their investors are this predominantly community of Silicon Valley venture capital firms, private equity, what have you, well connected, all know each other. And when the news came out, because the bank realized they had to raise some equity, so they filed with the SEC to sell some stock, raised some eyebrows. People looked at their actual balance sheet and said, this bank has to raise equity. Like, they're kind of screwed unless they do that. And they wouldn't have been screwed had the bank run not happened. So I guess what I'm saying in that is, it's a unique situation in that, unlike Wells Fargo or some bank that we all bank at, where it's a whole bunch of millions and millions of little mom and pop depositors, this was a bank that was comprised mostly of corporations, companies that had lots and lots of cash on deposit with it. So the $250,000 FDIC limit that almost no mom and pop investors would ever breach, and so that's known as uninsured deposits. Those deposits that are over that level are not covered by FDIC insurance. There's a ton of that at this bank. So the run on the bank was all these people talking with one another, like, "Hey, did you hear that SVB is gone? Take your money out." And they're within a couple of days, they're all doing their best to get their money out of the bank. And no matter whether it would be JP Morgan Chase or this bank, when everybody shows up on the same day, the bank is over. It's over. Right. So the run on the bank was caused kind of by the makeup of their customers, mismanagement of the bank itself by the executives, and the fact that that's the run on the bank part. The controversy comes in as it relates to the excess FDIC insurance, because the government decided to come in and bail out all of the depositors, and like some individual who had $20 million on deposit with the bank that normally would be on the hook for all but $250 of that was made whole. And so that, of course, is now turned into a political issue and a lot of debate on both sides as to whether that bailout, I'm using air quotes, was appropriate or not. I will say that the equity is zero. It's wiped out. So all the stockholders, including the executives, their equity in the bank is zero. Bondholders in the bank probably get cents on the dollar for theirs. The only ones made whole were the actual customers of the bank.
Made whole by who?
The government.
By who? Like, that comes from where?
It ultimately comes from taxpayers, no matter what they're going to tell you, because when they're trying to spin it as, well, we're going to impose some tighter regulations in the future on all banks that will include fees that they're not paying today. Those fees are going to be the source of the funds for this bailout, quote unquote. Well, we all know what happens when a business has more fees imposed on it. It passes them on to its customers. So to me, that's silly for anyone to say that this is not a taxpayer-funded bailout. It is, but at the same time, remember, it's a pretty small situation. This isn't the failure of JP Morgan.
Right.
This is a relatively minor bank. The issue, too, though, it's a spreading. There's a whole network of regional and community banks that do this, and they're very profitable because, like I said earlier, the regulations are more lax so that they can do things to make money that the bigger banks can't. Well, that's over. And so that, I think, explains why the regional banks as a whole have been just absolutely decimated. So they're down 50, 60%, whatever the numbers are. I don't think that's so much because people worry that they're going to fail. I think it's because people realize they ain't making the money they used to. So
right.
They're not as profitable.
So, I mean, this if the First Bank of Malvern has 3,000 clients, people that have deposits there. I mean, if 2,999 of them walked into the bank and said, we want all of our money, like, they'd go out of business. Right? I mean, it's not...
They, in theory, would go out of business. The question, though, now is the precedent has been set. So when and if that happens next, what happens? The other thing I'll say is that in the vast majority of those kinds of banks, it's no one has over $250,000
right.
in there. And I don't mean no one, but very, very small fraction of the dollars are that. So the insured deposits are still insured. So you should not, if you're a customer of a bank that has less than $250 in the bank, you should not be worried about your bank failing because you're going to get your money back.
So the person who has $20 million in SVB, I mean, pretty smart person, right? They have a lot of wealth.
Now you're getting into another subject, which is the community of VCs and private equity people who think they're so smart because of the amount of money they make.
Only $250 million is insured. Like, why would you have it there? Why would you have $20 million in one bank? Like, you should lose it. I'm sorry.
That's one of the arguments that a lot of people are making. And I got to say it.
Like, I don't feel bad for the 100 millionaire who lost $20 million because they kept $20 million in one stupid regional bank.
The other argument against you, though, is that some of these deposits are businesses that employ hundreds of people, let's say, and they're... the business account is way more than $250,000 in order to meet payroll and overhead and all that. And so that business would be subject to potentially going out of business and then people lose jobs and yada, yada, yada. So,
oh, well,
I
maybe that
you.
Person can take the other $80 million that they have somewhere else and keep their business afloat and keep their employees afloat. I just like just total... These people are supposed to be so smart and they're so stupid. I hate when people equate wealth to like intelligence.
Well,
there is no correlation.
You're dead right. And I think that this is just another item that has happened in the news that is exposing incompetence and mistaking wealth for brains, and the fact that, you know, you had how many years of zero interest rates where you could borrow for nothing and invest in anything and make money. And that happened in a grand scale across the landscape of private equity, VC, and a lot of others. And then the result is you get people who think they're so smart. And it extends even to these people who ran this bank and didn't think that interest rates could go up and we could be. And the second part of that's really important, which is that our customers all talk to one another. This isn't scattered amongst a bunch of mom and pops that have $5,000 in their bank account that don't know what's going on. These people hear that we are potentially undercapitalized, or we have losses on our investment portfolio that cause everybody to just run on your bank. And that was like maybe the biggest risk for this particular bank that they ignored, and they deserve everything they got, the executives, that is.
It's funny. It's like the story is always the same, and it's greed.
It's
right?
Greed, yeah.
It's like in 07, 08, when they started lending money, like you said, banking is very simple. And once you start to deviate from the simplicity of the business model and start to do things that you really probably shouldn't just to earn a little bit more because you possibly see an opportunity, it usually ends poorly. Like 07, 08, we started lending money to people that could not qualify for mortgages, but we just kept doing it and doing it and doing it until it collapsed. And it's the same storyline. And we were talking about this earlier. And Mike, you and I may have a different opinion on it. I'm very curious to get yours. Like, we've received some communications from clients like, hey, should I be concerned about my money market funds at Vanguard that have X amount of dollars in it, or my deposits in my bank at TD Bank? And my response is it possible that those things can lose value? Yeah, it's possible, but I think it's highly unlikely.
Well, they're two different things. The bank deposits are what we were talking about. That's FDIC insurance on bank deposits. Yep. Money market funds are not.
You have no concern over FDIC. As long as you keep it at 250 per registration, yep, you're totally fine.
Yeah.
It's federally backed, and we're all cool with that.
Yeah, and it's actually $500,000 if you have it jointly.
Right.
So, I mean, that's even better.
And it's per institution. So if you own it, if you happen to have that much money in bank accounts, you can diversify your risk if you choose to.
Right. I just hate that I have to go to 10 different banks all the time.
Oh, yeah, you have that much money in cash.
But money market funds are real because they
talk to me about that.
They're mutual funds. We're a little distant. They're not bank deposit. They're actually mutual funds, and they're the accounting structure of money market funds is that they're invested. Well, first of all, they're invested in short term assets like overnight loans and things like that. Like
treasuries,
yeah, and corporate and overnight corporate loans. So they're very short term in nature, and they pay interest that's comparable, usually better than banks, obviously, but it's comparable to, you know, treasury bills or something along those lines, or maybe slightly better. The problem or the issue is that it's not, none of it's guaranteed, and the accounting, the way the accounting works for money market funds is there, it's a $1 net asset value all the time. It's stable. It doesn't fluctuate. And the only way they've made that happen is just by an accounting method that operationally makes it a dollar per share. And then every month they pay you your interest / dividends, and away you go. There's the breaking the buck term means that when a money market fund's assets don't add up to the dollar per share, and maybe it's 99 cents or 95 cents or whatever. And that's happened before. But that's happened because of not a run on money market funds. It's happened because of a counterparty failure. Like, so back to, I think maybe the last time it happened was the 07, 08 time, and Lehman Brothers was a counterparty, I believe, to the one fund who had a lot of short-term loans, overnight loans to it. Lehman Brothers disappears in the middle of the night, and there's a portion of the assets that are worth zero, and it breaks the buck. I think, and honestly, I can't remember what the government, if they did anything to step in. I think the government would step in and do something in the event of a major like money market fund that broke the buck.
And it would be temporary. It's not like it's gonna go to 95 cents a share and you're never gonna get that back to a dollar a share.
Well, no, in that case it's not temporary. If you have a counterparty that defaults and your money's gone, that you're getting it back.
That's where you're saying the government would have to step in.
Yeah, because think about it, it's an investment, it's a mutual fund, an ultra short term mutual fund that only invests in like and forget about the T-bill stuff, because that's different, because that is not going to zero. But it's if you lend money to a corporation overnight and then they disappear, yeah, then you're not getting it back. So that's a permanent impairment.
So I hold a money market mutual fund, mm-hmm, and it drops to 95 cents a share.
Well, that would be like
99 cents, yeah, a share. Sorry. I lost money and I'm never getting that money back. It's never going to go back to $1 a share.
Not unless they recover in like some sort of bankruptcy. Like, not never, but it doesn't. There's no,
I don't mean overnight,
no reason it has to get back. It's basically like you invested, you lent to a counterparty that's not there anymore. It's not like the government. The SVB is so different because they owned treasuries, right? It's not, yeah, like that was just a time issue. If they waited until the bonds matured, everything would have been fine, but people wanted their money like today.
So if a client calls me and says, hey, should I be taking my money market funds and putting them in the various banks to get FDIC insurance? I mean, I feel like that's an unnecessary move.
I agree. I 100% agree.
And when would your tune change? When would you say, yep, you should definitely be thinking about doing that?
If my tune changed on that question, I think we have way bigger problems than a money market fund breaking the buck, or like a major one or a series of big ones. Cause then it's like some form of financial Armageddon going on.
Right.
That's way worse than we had before. So I don't live my life planning for that or worrying about it.
Okay.
So I don't know.
Good explanation, man.
Yeah, you did good.
That's like complicated stuff. He almost lost me a few times, but I stuck with it.
No,
when you said helpful. When you use the term counterparty, it kind of threw me off a little bit.
Yeah.
Are there considerations? I mean, we've talked about the FDIC level of insurance. Are there other things people should be thinking about when they do their banking in light of what we learned? Or is SVB small enough and unique enough and really only applicable to such a small group of people that it's like that'll very likely never be the masses?
When you say when people do their banking, are you talking about people that have nowhere near 250 in cash that they're holding?
No, and let's assume that 250 stays in place and everybody banking in that world is comfortable with it. But if there's a ultra, ultra conservative, right, person who doesn't want to own stocks or bonds and all they keep is their money in cash, right? And it's not 250, it's $1 million. Is it spread your risk among four different banks?
I would. And I think we've said that to people in the past. Like, yeah. It's a little bit more of a hassle, but I mean, FDIC can be important and
yeah,
it's been marketed to be important. In this case, it wasn't, but
right,
this is a unique case, I think. So I would say, yeah, that would be my advice, is just spread it around, use different registrations, max out your, like, keep it all under the insurance umbrella, and yeah. And then
you'll be fine.
Yeah, I agree. And then we mentioned earlier, I don't know if this is, it's related, but SIPC insurance, and that covers your investments that sit inside of a brokerage account at a broker dealer. That's everyone you can think of. It's Schwab, Fidelity, Vanguard, Merrill Lynch, whatever. So investments, not cash at a bank. They've been forever subject to similar insurance, but up to $500,000. The thing that's a little different there is that virtually every brokerage firm buys private insurance in for amounts of I think 25, 50, even over $100 million. So for anyone who's worried about what about my investments that are sitting in a brokerage account somewhere and that broker dealer fails, well, that's happened many, many times. And all you do is they transfer your accounts to another brokerage firm. Right. Nothing changes. You still hold the same stuff. Nobody ran off in the middle of the night with it. But that insurance is in place in the event that there's a failure. I mean, I know when Madoff failed or went under, SIPC insurance did play a role in the recovery of some of those people's assets. Obviously, it wasn't all of it, but there's that. Mm-hmm.
Good stuff, man.
Cool.
Wow, pretty technical coaches' corner.